Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Carl Carlson.
Hey, Carl. Hey, we got a question from one of our listeners, and somebody reached out to us and said, hey, I got this question. And I'll paraphrase. There's a couple of paragraphs long, but basically said it's a question regarding demonstration testing. But I think the question applies to pretty much any test that we do in reliability world. And he said, it's an example. And I know Anton doesn't work for Apple, so he picked iPhone so we could relate to it. Let's say I wanted to do a demonstration test that we're interested in how many drops before a crack screen occurs. And I'm glad he didn't ask me how to do drop testing for glass, but because that's a really complicated subject. But basically said, this is an example. Let's say we're setting up a drop test and we have a little bit of background information, and we set up a binomial based test, and we know that we got to drop, say, 20 times. I'm just making these numbers up, 20 times. And if it passes with the number of samples we have, we know it's good. And that's a common test technique when you have information about the frequency, the distribution, or the expected time to failure type information. And you can do a success test, is what I call it. And then the question gets interesting. He said, when we run this test, we run the number of samples and none of the screens crack. And so I'm tempted to say that I have 90% confidence that we have a 90% or better reliability based on those test results for the population. And theoretically, mathematically, that's what that means. And then he said, yet we did have a couple of unrelated failures internal that, you know, the battery connection came off, one of the buttons is not working, they were different failure mechanisms, not cracked screens, which was what they were designing the test for, but other mechanisms occurred. And it was, can I still say I have a 90% confidence of a 90% or better reliability for cracked screens or not? And I thought, well, okay, I have to unpack this a bit. So, I mean, what's your initial thought of this question?
Talk about this, as you say, irrespective of any brand. In other words, if you take a given failure mechanism for whatever it is, in this case, a crack screen, but it could be on any device at all, mm-hmm. and just talk about principles. Let me go back a ways on. I'll try to summarize first, and then go back and share some stories that support it. But in summary, there's a lot of assumptions that go into success testing. And I've always had a bias towards test to failure for a lot of reasons, unless you have enough failure information to know better what your parameters are that support the distribution mm-hmm. That you're using. And so, but just going into success testing without the hard evidence of time to failure, that brings up a lot of assumptions. And so if you assume, for instance, a Weibull parameter, a beta, that assumption has consequences if you're off. And I've seen over the years, a lot of errors. Well, let's just assume a 2.0, we assume a 1.5 without data that supports it. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to get erroneous information. So the first thought is if you're going to use success testing without ever having tested to failure to really understand your failure distributions, then you've got some potential errors in your assumptions. And I don't just go by textbook and say, well, let's just assume this or that right. without understanding the consequences. So that's the first thought and off the top of my head. And then the next one is the mechanisms of failure. Mm-hmm. My reaction there goes back to The original training I got from Dorian Shannon on Weibull analysis, this goes back into the early 90s when we brought him into General Motors. And so I learned Weibull before there was software, mm-hmm. before there was anything.
It
was
graph all paper.
Yeah, exactly. I have a file, a folder full of Weibull graph paper that I'll never use in the rest of my life.
Oh, you should pull one out on, you know, Waddle Weibull's birthday and at least plot 10 points. Come on.
Yeah, so, right. And so I think I understand the principles around it because he really taught the principles, not how you plug in numbers into a software package. And then one of the takeaways I remember from that is the importance of having a common mechanism. In other words, when you do a Weibull distribution, but of course then he's testing to failure and he's using, there may be some truncated results, but a lot of failure information. Mm-hmm. And so knowing what the mechanism is and staying within that mechanism is another principle that I walk away with. But then commingling with others is a topic.
Yeah. Well, that brings up, you know, cracked glass from Drop. And the reason I mentioned that's a complicated subject from the start is that glass can break from so many different paths. And what you're seeing, a crack in the piece of glass, for example, or whatever particular mechanism, but let's say it's a piece of glass, that crack could be from different underlying mechanisms. I mean, for example, could be defects in the creation of the glass. It could be inherent stress in its attachment. It could be accumulated damage on some support system that failed that then allowed the next drop to create the failure in the glass. It didn't protect it. If there's shock absorbing systems involved and those deteriorate with more stress, then they fail. It could be a hot cold phenomena. It could be a twist phenomena. It could be, you know, on and on and on and on. There's a lot of ways to break glass. And what brought that home to me is that years and years ago, I was studying a ceramic, multi-layer ceramic capacitors. And I think it was AMP or one of the other major capacitor vendors created a paper that said, if the crack looks like this, it's probably this phenomena, this kind of stress. If a crack looks like this, then that comes from this type of mechanism and so on. And it allowed you to read the cracks to interpret where the problem was and how to go do the root cause. It's similar to if you have a fractured bolt, you can interpret the surface of that fracture to piece together the story of how it failed and what was the nature of the failure. And so there's, with glass, if you're seeing exactly the same initiation of the failure and same pattern through the thing, that's great. But my daughter actually had a couple of phones and dropped them and sat on them and did everything else. And those cracks never did look the same. You know, so I that would be a tough one to unravel.
Yeah. And so, but again, from a principal standpoint, in other words, irrespective of anything else, the analyst has to be aware of the mechanism of failure.
Yeah. And it's different than the mode. It's different than the symptoms you're seeing. That's my point. Yeah.
Yes. Failure mechanism is the underlying chemical, physical, thermodynamic, whatever that mechanism of failure. It's the underlying physics of the failure.
Right.
And so lumping together a lot of disrelated mechanisms makes your results less, you can have less confidence in your results. And so you want to be aware of what the mechanisms of failure are. But when you're doing success testing, you're not really concerned about that because you're essentially in a no failure. That's why it's called success testing.
Right.
Or you say one failure or that type of thing. And so I really, the biggest caution to Anto is to be careful about what your assumptions are on success testing and try to test a failure if possible.
Right.
That to me makes the most sense because I've had the beta in the Weibull parameter can have a lot of variation in the real world. In other words, if you, and I did this, I had a summer student years ago in the early 90s at GM And I set the summer student off on a project to understand beta variation on different types of tests and different types of failure mechanisms, and then what the impact of that is. And it's the only time I've ever done a study. I wish I'd kept that folder because I've never seen a study that says, okay, we're going to assume a 1.5 beta. Well, what if it's a 1.7 or a 1.4 or a 2.0? Mm-hmm. How does that impact the results? And the other comment I'll make, which is a different subject entirely, but it's into the reliability statistics space, is confidence intervals.
Yep.
And you don't just pick randomly a confidence interval. And some people think, oh, it's purely statistics. I'll just pick a 50%. Therefore, I'll need less samples.
Or, yep.
And therefore, I'm saving money. But there's a consequence to that. And in a podcast of the time we have, we can't go into a huge amount of detail of what that is. But I think users should be aware of the assumption or the adoption of a confidence interval as part of your calculation, because that affects a lot of the results.
Exactly. Now, there's another part to this question, is those other failures, you know, like
yes.
a broken button or a battery disconnect or stuff like that. My initial thought on that is you can't ignore those. I mean, if you had everything else we talked about was good, you could treat those units as sensor data, but now you don't have the number of samples that pass. Now, you don't need the electronics to know if your screen is cracked or not. So I think you could censor those, but keep dropping them, essentially. And then I thought, wait a second, these things are pretty intermingled and everything's connected to everything else. And
when you have a
screen that's connected, if the button fails, there's some mechanical damage to the housing,
which affects the integrity of the glass structure. I mean,
yeah,
it's the same thing I was thinking, Fred, which is the interdependence.
Yeah, they're not independent. Because, yeah.
And that's one of the assumptions going in is independence. In other mm-hmm. words, so if there's an interdependence like you're bringing up, then that affects the results. So then you can get into, okay, so what if we don't make any assumptions? What am I? I've got too many things going through my mind right now. The beta assumption relates to a mechanism.
Right.
In other words, I don't think you have a beta assumption just on, you know, 55 different failure mechanisms. And so because you could do just a success run without the Weibull parameters.
Right.
And that's one thing. You could do a system testing and say, okay, for no failures, what's the sample size? What's the confidence? What's the time to run, which really could be the time to run past the design life or something, mm-hmm. Irrespective of mechanisms. But then you're not entering into the parameters of characteristics of life, beta,
right,
or any other parameters, and the results have to be interpreted in that way. So you can, that's another option.
It is, yet it's
not a great option.
Not a great option, no. Yeah. I think it is an option, and many people do it because it's economical. But which brings up another part of it, and we haven't touched on it yet, is that in the design of a test, and I'm thinking drop test is this example illustrates, well, how do you interpret the 22 drops you do onto, you know, a wood floor or concrete floor or whatever you're dropping it on, to the use experience that is at random heights, random velocities, random surfaces? How do you translate your lab experience to the use experience? Because you're almost always many steps away from how people actually use your device and how it gets dropped. You know, are you running through the airport on a marble floor, or are you in a shop floor and it gets run over by a forklift, or is it,
Yeah, the way we describe that in our group in GM, and it's not, I'm sure it's very similar in other companies, is the percentile customer use conditions. Yep. Yep. So we went to we actually used 99.8 percentile.
Oh, wow. So that would cover the neighborhood dragster that goes up and down our street.
Yeah, yes. And but the idea there is that by doing that type of course, that meant we had a lot of data of use conditions, which mm-hmm. we did. But in other words, you set some use condition, and then you test to that use condition, which is obviously going to be well above the average.
And, oh, yeah.
But then it can be part of your reliability statistics in interpreting the results.
Well, that brings up, I ran into, it was a button, a device with a handheld controller, essentially, and it had all these buttons on it. And so they had a test set up and these little pneumatic hammers, which I had some problems with because it just replicates the exact same deflection every time. But people don't do that. And it turned out that didn't matter. You could attack this dome button all kinds of ways, and it still does the same phenomena. But I digress. They had all these buttons, and they set up a test, and they were doing 1 million cycles per button. And I says, why are you doing that? And says, well, the buttons are rated for that. Well, what's that got to do with how you use it?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
You know, is the fire button on this game controller used 1 million times or 2 million times? Or is it used 87,000 times? And, you know, and what kind of force deflections are on it and how often?
Yeah.
And you got this other reset button that's used maybe 10 times in its entire life and you're testing it 1 million times. What are you wasting your time for? And right. So they said, well, we don't know how often people push these buttons.
We'll find out.
So it happened by happenstance, just by saying, we need to know how many times people push buttons, right? And they had all the capability to do that. They had gamers coming in, different levels of gamers, you know, from beginners to pro level, come in to their shop and they were play testing these new games and new equipment. And so it was part of the human factors team or something like that was they were already doing all this stuff. And so they had another little device that would read the wireless signal, slow it down, not translate it, not anything else. The game would go on as normal, but it would sense all of the button activations. And it would just drop it into a big old spreadsheet. And then we could scan through it and say, how many times did you push the X button? How many times did you push the A button? How many times did you do this? In for a given, you know, duration of time that we're doing it. And then we were able to extrapolate out that actually pros don't push the buttons near as much as the advanced amateur that just sprays stuff all over the place.
But do they push harder or softer?
Oh, it was interesting. The pros preload the button so that it has a quicker response time.
Right.
And it's very subtle. But but anyway, we found out that, you know, as we expected, different buttons had different amounts of use. And some of it was dependent on what game you were playing. So we ended up with, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of these files of playtesting. And different kinds of games and everything else. And so we just pile it all together and said, how many times is the X button typically used? We had a distribution and we did exactly what you were talking about. We didn't use 99.8. I think we used 95% tile. And it was like 300,000 times in the expected lifetime of one of these things for the most used button at that percentile. So,
yeah.
And then for many of the buttons, we just got rid of the test. It just did not matter. This button was only going to be used 15 times ever. You know,
that's a waste of time.
Waste of time. So we got rid of like 3/4 of the testing and reduced the other ones. And then we started testing to failure. And they rarely, if ever, survived 1 million cycles. That rating was just fiction.
Interesting. I remember one of my first classes in Weibel. This is after Dorian. Dorian's so funny. I just got to share this 15 seconds. when he comes in, first time into GM, and every time thereafter, this is before we had PowerPoints mm-hmm. and presentations and stuff. We had these ViewGraph machines.
Yep.
Old timers will remember them. And he would come in with, we'd have the ViewGraph machine. He'd come in and he'd plop on top of the ViewGraph machine on his, he would write with a magic marker on the ViewGraph sheet. Mm-hmm. And then on top of it, he'd put a swizzle stick that he had in his pocket from the cocktails on the first class
for the flight out there. Yeah.
Yeah. So we had all these pointers. We didn't have laser pens or anything, but we had swizzle sticks. But going on to the story, I was going to say, the first class I took in Weibel, you probably recall this, but it's because it's used all the time, is the paperclip
yep.
exercise.
Yep.
And so you open up the paperclip and then you start twisting it. And then you're supposed to like twist it a certain number of times until it breaks.
Right.
And I was a new student and I raised my hand. I said, well, what if you twist it too far? And in other words, you've actually gone into the yield portion of the little.
You overstressed it. Yeah.
The instructor looked at me and said, that's not part of the exercise. He frowned.
So all of mine failed on one.
Yeah, right. Or you could twist it too far on one of them, and then suddenly when you're in the normal range, it would break sooner.
Yeah.
But that's all part of the SN curve, I guess it's called.
That's right. If you get out of the elastic region, you're playing in a different yeah. field.
So there's things like that to think about when you're doing Weibel testing. Well, go ahead, Fred.
Well, it goes back to this question, though, is that one is there's lots of mechanisms at play, and which complicates this. Two is check your assumptions. And I think we say that all the time. Understand and check your assumptions, both from a failure mechanism point of view, but also the statistics. And then when you have, we didn't really close it out, was if you have these other mechanisms, is are they really independent? And that's right. a complicated test to run to make sure that they are. So you basically can't assume independence, especially in a complex mechanical structure. And right. those become mass, basically, of your real failures. And that then negates your success testing capability. It all goes back to that when you sit down to design a test, success test or any of them, is you got to think through all of these assumptions and all of these nuances so that at the end of the day, you get meaningful results. Either we successfully pass this and it translates to X, Y, and Z in the real world, and here's why we know this, or it doesn't, and here's why it failed. But if you get this ambiguous result going, well, we kind of threw out a beta and because we think it's about 2 and that's a nice number. If you start like that, then you're in big trouble.
So assumptions matter.
They do. So it's one of those things that, one, thanks Anto for the question and letting us talk about it and expose it, but it reinforces the need for us in the reliability profession and for those that are interested in reliability to ask those questions. So if somebody comes up with a test plan, a common question to ask is, well, how does this relate to what we need to know? Or how does this relate to the real world? Where are we going to use this information? What assumptions are involved here and which ones are important that we need to verify or check or understand? You know,
and if you're a listener and you have experience on this or questions or have you run into things, we'd love to hear from you because we only touched on the subject in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And I bet there's a lot of things we didn't cover. And so please let us know. And how do they do that, Fred?
Oh, come on, Carl. You've heard this so many times. We just looked it up before we started it. You've got close to 150 episodes here. But is head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And there you'll find two ways to get in touch with us, a contact form and a SpeakPipe widget that allows you to record a voice message to us. You can also find Carl and I and the other hosts of the show on LinkedIn or on our About pages on Ascendo Reliability. As Carl mentioned, we truly do enjoy hearing from you, and we really want you to become part of the conversation. So we look forward to hearing from you. So with that, Carl, let's go break things. This talk of drop testing makes me want to go do stuff.
That sounds like fun.
All right. Talk to you later, Carl.
Talk to you later, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.